around the world, this is Paper Cuts with Brad and Jay.
I'm the one you love. I'm Jay. Thanks so much for stopping by. Over there's Brad. It's his show.
It's his show. That's why I'm the host, and we just love Jay.
Like, I don't know if I'm just dumbfounded, amazed, shocked, or what. God, you just suck life out of me. It feels like
you've got a lot grayer since we started this.
I have. Tonight, it's the Scratching the Flint release party with Vern Smith and special guests.
We are live.
Hey, that's my cue. What's up, everyone? What better place to be on a Friday evening than with your pals here at Paper Cuts? And we have a house full this evening. A full house. Usually, Brad and I, we have to sweet talk people and persuade people and blackmail people to come on the show for us, you know, so we can have a little bit of a schedule.
But don't give our secrets away, Jay.
I'm building it up for a reason because I'm going to use the word honor and privilege because it is an honor when someone reaches out to us, says, "Hey, Brad, hey, Jay. You want to do a little book release party?" And we're like, okay, what else are we going to do? we need people to come on. So that's what we're doing this evening. We have a huge release. Tomorrow's the official release day for Scratching the Flint. It enters the world from Run Amok. And our special guest right now, Vern Smith. That's who's joining us. He brought a lot of people with him too. So Vern, what's going on, buddy? Why don't you go around the room and introduce all your gang here to us?
All right. Well, we already know Brad and Jay.
No one cares about us though. It's all about you.
You guys already had a lot of airtime at the beginning there. At my left, anyways, is A.B. Patterson, the great Australian crime writer, and you need to check out his Harry Kenmare novels as well as his short story collection. Harry Kenmare, and I just read the short story collection. Harry Kenmare, PI at your service, was fabulous. I gave that 5 stars on Goodreads. We have in the middle here Gary Anderson, who's the managing editor of Run Amok Books, and I've been publishing with Gary and Run Amok for the last 5 years, and So he's there in the middle. Joey R. Poole at the end. And Joey is he's the editor of Swamp, the horror anthology. And he's also the author of a fabulous short story collection. I have always been here before. And at different points in the development of Scratching the Flint, both AB and Joey were incredibly valuable to me. In terms of me running to them crying and getting a little bit of help, and I think we'll be getting into that tonight. But there is the round table.
There's the crew. There's the gang, and we're all here to celebrate the actual release of Scratching the Flint, which is like I said earlier, entering the world tomorrow. So what better time to celebrate than the night before so we can all get smashed and sleep in.
Jay. We're being responsible.
Ooh, I'm sorry. Okay. You go ahead. Be responsible. Go ahead. I think I'm going to be a non-drinker right tonight too, by the way. I have water. Everyone else has
some. You counseled me to drink.
I was trying to get you to. I mean, more beer the better.
I see how this is going now.
It was a trap. So
Bart, how long has Scratching the Flint been in the works? Is that something you started writing a few years ago or something you put out pretty quick?
Well, it's been a very, very long time. So actually, all my novels, The Green Ghetto, Under the Table, and Scratching the Flint, are collaborations between my younger self, something I started in my 30s, and something I finished in my 50s. I got an opportunity. I was working on The Green Ghetto when I got this job opportunity to work at my hometown public radio station. And I had it on my screen when they called up and offered me the job. And I thought, geez, I'm never going to finish this, right? Yeah. And so between 2010 and 2016, I really didn't write at all. I thought when I took this job that I was going to be able to write it right at night and on weekends. And, you know, in my naivete, the job turned out to be 24/7, 365. And, you know, all the crazy dookie that goes on at a public radio station with more than 100 volunteers. And so, you know, so I was sort of interrupted there. And then when I moved here to the States, I got back into things, finished the Green Ghetto, finished Under the Table. Scratching the Flint was, I'd completely forgotten about it. And I found it when we were putting out my short story collection, The Gimmick. And it was a 27,000 word novella or novelette. I think that's a novella, but you know, whatever, it doesn't matter. And so when I was piecing together the collection, I looked at it and I could have included it. It was something I'd never done before. It was originally written as a mystery, and I don't write mysteries, I write crime fiction. And I pulled it out of the box and I vaguely recalled it. And I read the first chapter. And, you know, you those of you who've read the book, you will recall the reference to write in Dick Gregory for president. And I said, okay, you know, it's a good first chapter, but, you know, this all has to be a thread. And so let's read it. And I read it all the way through and I was happy with it. It hung together, but I did feel that it had the potential to be a full-length novel. And so it was as soon as I finished Under the Table, I was at work on it. And the interesting thing about this is The Green Ghetto and Under the Table were more editing jobs, where this was an actual writing job. And like I said, I decided to turn it into a crime fiction novel as opposed to a mystery, and develop the criminal characters a little bit more, seeing that it wasn't a mystery. And so, you know, so this was something that was started roughly in the time that it was set. And I pulled it out of my short story collection and developed it further. And so it would have been started, you know, approximately 2001. And I finished it in 2020, I believe.
Wow.
It was my lockdown project, and it, you know, as grim as that time and place was, you know, it was sort of better than the here and now. And so I was able, you know, to escape every day into a world that was 4 or 5 months before 9/11. And as I say, you know, 9/11 wasn't an end of innocence; it was an end of perceived influence, but still, you know, you can go back there with some blinders on and stopped watching the news and just, you know, for 6 or 8 months, just hunkered down and had fun with my characters, drank with them at night. And, you know, that's a big part of the process with all of them. And, you know, it came together. Actually, I shouldn't say it came together quite quickly once I got in on it, but, you know, it was about 6 or 8 months work, and I'm pleased the way it turned out. And you know, I think really one of the things about it is my younger self had the wherewithal to document a lot of this, what was going on, what Toronto looked like in that time and place. And, you know, I think I lacked a certain amount of finesse at that point. I think I was still, to a certain extent, learning and reaching out for help and things like that. And my older self, you know, I'm not having the same wild experiences I had, you know, when I was living in downtown Toronto in my 20s and 30s. And so, you know, my older self was able to, you know, settle things down and I think bring a finesse into it. And this is my third novel, and they've all been sort of switch-hitting plots, A story, B story, A story, B story, until the two intersect. And, and you know, I by the time I got to Scratching the Flint, I was a lot more competent, I think, in terms of doing that. And you know, so here we are, it's 20 years later, and it's been a long road, but I wouldn't have it any other way.
Now, Gary, when he brought you scratching the flint, where you're like, well, damn, it's about time. Have you been waiting for this for 12 years? Well, what was the process with getting it to you and getting it out into the public?
Well, I haven't known Vern for 20 years, so.
When he said this is 20 years in the making, did you say this is better be damn good?
Better be.
Well, it was, yeah. I don't actually remember the precise moment that he dropped it on me, but I was always, I had always said to him, whatever you got, I want to see it. So I think he just showed it to me one day, and I started reading it, and you know, I've of course I'm a fan because I have published his other novels and his short stories, so I was not disappointed at all. I think it's probably, and Vern probably would agree, I think it's the strongest one yet. So very happy to have been able to publish it for him.
Now, people who've got a copy of The Gimmick, they're going to see Alex and Cecil up here in Scratching the Flint, right? So they started out in The Gimmick, right, Vern?
Yes.
So was it always your intention to just continue those two characters? Are we going to see like a whole Vern Smith universe of those characters going doing whatever? More books to come from them?
Well, the first one I wrote, the Gimmick is the first story I wrote in that sort of cycle of these characters. And there are three stories in a novel. And the Gimmick I flat out wrote over 6 weeks, basically, you know, working every morning, early in the morning until lunch every day, and submitted it to an anthology on the now defunct Insomniac Press label. And it got in the anthology, and it was shortlisted for an Arthur Ellis Award. And I thought, well, you know, maybe I'm going to make a franchise out of these guys. And so I wrote a couple other stories and developed the characters. They're also in The Gimmick. There's another story, An International Incident, which is set on a Cuban beach. And Alex, Cecil, we talk about Cecil, but he's not actually in the story. But the other person, the other main protagonist in that story is Sandra, Alex's girlfriend. And so through that story and through The Gimmick, I developed some characters that we poured into Scratching the Flint. And you know, certainly that was valuable in terms of having some three-dimensional people to work with. You know, it just, like I said, I got that radio job and, you know, put everything in boxes and moved back to Windsor, right? And so it's really interesting revisiting these characters that I developed and, you know, to a certain extent met 20 years ago, and now dealing with them in my 50s. I can remember coming across the characters that became Alex and Cecil. I was covering a lot of police matters for I Magazine at the time in Toronto. And I'd gone to a press conference at police headquarters, and there was a diner attached to it, which is in Scratching the Flint, called Friends. And after the press conference, I went over to Friends for a coffee and to go over my notes, and I picked up some press releases. And there were these two men. Franz is basically attached to police headquarters in Toronto. Right. And there were these two men at the next table over from me. And there was a senior black officer that I took as a detective. And, you know, there was this young, mouthy white guy who I also took as a police officer of some sort. And he became Cecil. And what I can remember, I don't remember any specific conversation between them, but I can remember the younger officer being shockingly disrespectful, and, you know, and so Cecil became, you know, Alex and Cecil sort of grew out of that. And then, you know, I think it was 2003, we went to Cuba for a holiday, and you know, I'm sure the Alex character was there at the same resort as us, and so I remember, you know, sort of following him down to the beach with his girlfriend, and you know, sitting near them, and this incident unfolded, and I basically, you know, for the most part, simply recorded what was going on, and that became a piece of autobiographical fiction. So, you know, I'm pretty familiar with them through these experiences, and they're at this point. I'm not really a sequel guy, but I could see working them into something else, you know, down the road in the future. You know, maybe playing a minor part. You know, and if I ever did anything on a grander scale, I think I would have to go into the here and now, because it would be pretty. It's a tough thing to write historical fiction, and the reason I'm able to do it is because I was basically doing it back in the day when I was creating all this stuff. And like I said, I'm you know, I think it's best that I'm finishing them up now, because I think they're all much deeper and more competent books.
Right.
It's interesting. You were talking about earlier, there's like a 20-year gap from when you started to when you finished it. Do you feel like there's a difference in the writing from, you know, the earlier parts of it when you started as a younger person, as opposed to, you know, when you finished it up, you know, 20 years later? Do you think you can tell, like, this is started, this is the new part started?
Well, I can tell in terms of the writing and the finesse. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think I was a little bit more of a blunt object, if you will, when I was a kid. And, you know, you have that 6 years off when I was working in radio. I wasn't writing fiction, but everything around a radio station revolves around writing letters, writing notes, writing briefing things, things like that. And I always said that nothing made me a better writer than writing disciplinary letters. Because there's no place to hide. There's utterly no place to hide, and they have to be perfect, you know, particularly in this day and age. And so when I opened up The Green Ghetto and finished that, you know, I think in 2017, I did feel a higher competence. I felt things were much more fluid in terms of me going in and operating, if you will. And you know, it really comes down to the young person had the experience and observations, and, you know, old man Smith had to come in and clean everything up, you know? And so that's basically how it worked. And it's actually, you know, to me, it's very idyllic. I mean, I look at my first book, Glue for Breakfast, which was published in 1996. And I self-deprecatingly refer to it as my disco album, you know, because and there are good stories in there, but, you know, I can see the unevenness, and I can see, you know, a certain rigidness and you know, basically, I don't want to say ham-handed, but you know, it's not smooth, it's not fluid like I think I am now. And so, you know, certainly I got older and I got better, and you know, I bow at the altar of the artifact, and I think these are better artifacts for me having gone through the process that I did. I'm a Gen Xer, and we have, you know, we tend to have a lot of careers as opposed to the people who came before us and, you know, basically went to Manpower and got a ticket and went across the street and worked somewhere for 45 years. And my life hasn't been like that. I've been a journalist. I've been a political hack. I've been a broadcaster and a station manager of a radio station. And, you know, now that I'm a little bit older, I'm a novelist and a short story writer as well. And so all the things I've done, I think, contribute to me being a better writer at this point. And I, you know, I look back when I picked up these manuscripts, and I could see when I was, I don't want to say a kid, but when I was a lot younger, I could see how I was looking for help. And of course, I'm still looking for help. Everybody needs a good editor. And fortunately, we've got a fabulous one at Run Amok, Krista Winsheimer. And, you know, and certainly Joey and AB here helped me out quite a bit. But yeah, it's I would, like I said, I wouldn't change anything. I think that, you know, I needed, my game needed some work, you know, and that's what it comes down to. My game needed some work. And it was great that I was recording all this stuff and having experiences, but I needed some finesse. And I think I have that now.
Well, let's put Joey and AB on the spot here. When you two read the book, what was your initial reaction? And you got to be truthful now because he's right here in front of us. You know? AB, let's start with you since you're in the future. By the way, he's like, what, 14 hours ahead of everybody right now.
It's Saturday for him. Yeah, he's from the future.
It's 10:20 Saturday morning down here. well, first reaction, I absolutely loved it. I think I came to it fairly late in the piece, and Vern had asked me to do a blurb for the novel. And I think based on my professional background, which is both a detective and a corruption investigator, so the subject matter was right up my alley.
Yeah.
Apart from the fact that I write crime and fiction myself. But
right.
And yeah, the two things that really stood out and made it special for me were firstly the absolute realistic depiction of corruption and the insidious effect it has on everybody in the society, because there's not really anybody in that novel who's clean.
Thank you.
in some way, there's something going down for everyone. And I think that very accurately shows that there's very little black and white in this in our societies. And I don't think, you know, I think Canada, the US, Australia, I think they're all fairly similar in that regard. So the corruption side of it was fascinating. Obviously, not having any experience of Canada and Toronto, some of that was very interesting because it was new to me, obviously. And some of the delightful little, did you pronounce it, Quebecois? Phrases, you know, the avec mocking, all those lovely little French words that are thrown in there, were great. But the, look, the other ask, the second part that really struck me as superb was Vern's depiction of those police characters, because a lot of crime that I read a lot of crime fiction, but all too often you see some very artificial or stereotyped depictions of cops.
Yeah,
which to me, sort of having been there and worked in the streets, albeit a long time ago now, you know, you pick up on those things straight away. But as I said to Vern, when I gave him my blurb, you know, the police personalities and the dialogue and the banter between them, I thought was just bang on. Notwithstanding, they're Canadians, and I come from an Australian background, but from the whole police culture bit, that really worked for me. So I think it was excellent.
So you think they have more of an authentic feel than what some of the stereotypes out there that you see some a lot of other stories?
Yeah, absolutely. Because I've read a couple of local crime authors here who I never name an author when I say something a little bit negative. But
just tell us who you're talking about.
Give us the initials, at least.
They're very successful, but then I've read them and the depictions of the police characters. You think, no, that simply doesn't work. Look, for a lot of readers, they're probably never going to pick up on that. But I think, and obviously, whilst you know, I said in my blurb that for somebody who hasn't worked in law enforcement, I think Vern's probably done the best depiction I've seen. Obviously, you've being a journalist back in the day, you've mixed with the law enforcement. I remember it from the other side of the coin, drinking with the journos. So, very, very interesting times back in the 80s and 90s. But yeah, no, I think it's a brilliant depiction of them. And look, I'd love to read them again. In fact, it was a pleasure when I got this one after I'd read the manuscript. So that, sorry, that's the gimmick on screen now. And then, of course, suddenly rediscovered the two characters in there, which is great.
So you kind of went backwards to...
Yeah, absolutely. Okay.
Yeah. Joey, what was your impression of this? Vern, Jeffs, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to cut
you off. Before I get out of order, I just want to, you know, mention one thing about AP's going through it. AB Patterson going through it. I was initially a little bit concerned about sharing it with an actual cop because I was afraid, right? You know,
I'll start picking things out for you.
right. And you know, and I gave it to AB to do a blurb, and you know, he ended up doing a pretty big assist as far as I'm concerned. I'm a stickler for accuracy in Canada. You know, if you're a journalist and push comes to shove, you have to be able to prove your story. And it's not like that in the United States. You just have to believe it's true, which is very, very, very convenient. But, you know, it's a very important thing to me. And there's a gun in the story. The chief weapon in the story, as you guys know, is a Zippo. And in part, that's because in Canada, we've got strict gun control. It's not to say guns don't get in. But, you know, when Canadians absolutely positively have to neutralize somebody, you know, sometimes that means they have to be creative. And so anyways, there was a couple extra guns in the story. One of them was a Smith & Wesson Model 10, and it's a revolver. And I'd actually done some research. I called Toronto Police and emailed them and asked them questions about the specs of their cars, weapons, things like that. But, you know, again, being a Canadian, I don't have a lot of experience shooting guns. And, you know, and I've got somebody flicking on and off the safety on the Smith & Wesson Model 10, and there's no safety on revolvers. And, you know, this was a key assist. And, you know, AB sent me a very sensitive note beyond that. And you know, and I was extremely grateful. And, you know, something we found about 2 weeks before publication. And, you know, so it just goes to show, you know, you do need help, and, you know, you do need people looking at your work and correcting you on occasion. And it you know, AB, that was a key assist. And I'm so grateful for that. These things are important to me, and I really appreciate that.
It was an absolute pleasure, mate.
Thank you.
And like most people probably wouldn't catch that, but, you know, for the sticklers for details, you know, like you, Vern, that's probably something that would stick out. If you was out and didn't catch it, like, oh man, I can't believe I did that.
I would know it's there. Would know it's there. And eventually
find the one gun enthusiast that's Canada that's, you know, right now.
Yeah.
You know, you're that guy. It's like, okay, no, and writing the hate letter to you. Well, if you would have done your research, you would have known, you know. I get to see it now. So,
oh yeah, yeah. Well, it's you know what, it's you get it as right as you can, and I'm very grateful that we got that part right. And I just wanted to mention that before we moved on.
Yeah, Joey was going to tell us when you read it, his take on everything.
Well, I'll just speak to the quality of the writing. I really like I've admired this in Vern's writing for a while now. The way he, when you read his books, and it's like especially this one, you can see the bones of his influences, like hardboiled detective fiction, but it never feels like hackneyed in the way that sometimes that does. And if anybody needs an introduction to the book, just read the first chapter. I don't want to give too much away here, but that Zippo Vern was referring to makes an appearance, and the whole thing is just quietly brutal. In a way that I found very unsettling the first time I read the book. I actually read that first chapter and I put it down for a while because, like I said, it was very quietly brutal. Maybe I wasn't in the right headspace. But that kind of tone kind of, you know, plays out throughout the entire novel. And that's one thing that I really admire about Vern's writing.
Well, thank you. One thing I just want to jump in here as well. Joey read the manuscript years ago. This would have been about 3 years ago. It would have been about 2020 when I was sort of just coming around the mountain on the book. And I was getting towards the end, and I got into a rabbit hole, I believe, if I'm recalling correctly, about details such as eye color and things along those lines. And I really was on the verge of doing too much. And, you know, I my younger self, you know, would have just like kept banging the keys and trying to work it out and probably making things worse. And, you know, fortunately I had the wherewithal to sort of say to myself, okay, you need to back away from the keyboard and think about this and, you know, call somebody before you make it worse. Right. And Joey and I published, and this is sort of how we met. Joey and I had published short stories in Bull at that time. Mm-hmm. And this was one of the stories that made it into Joey's book. I've always been here before. What was the name of the story, Joey? I'm sorry.
The story's called No Harm at All.
Right. Correct. And I'd read Joey's story, and Joey was not in trouble in any of the areas that I was concerned about, and had dealt with all those very well. And I you know, it's a while back now. I don't remember our conversation verbatim, but he spent, you know, generously spent a great deal of time on the phone with me, and we talked through it. And I felt after I got off the phone with him that, you know, I knew what I was doing, or sort of thought I knew what I was doing. And, you know, went in and sort of did the surgery and finished up the book. And, you know, again, very grateful to have been able to draw on Joey's expertise as an author and as an educator. And, you know, got to the point where I felt I could finish the book, and I did finish it, obviously. And, you know, again, a key assist, and, you know, you do need to reach out to the right people and get the right kind of help. And I got that from both Joey and AB.
I remember you called me wanting to know more about how to do good physical description, which I thought was an odd choice to call me, because it seems like I don't do a whole lot of it.
Well, but I think that was the key, is not to get bogged down in that.
Yeah. I like how you're comparing your older self with your younger self. It's called wisdom over the years. It's wisdom.
Those gray hairs you got there, right, Jay?
The young. They just won't know what the old know, you know. It's always that old saying, what would you go back and tell your younger self? You know, you probably heard that before. Like, this is a perfect example, because, you know, your younger self, you would have just been gone crazy with it. Now, finishing it all these years later, you can slow it down. You can figure out the right path for everything. So, it's a key point right here. I think Brad's the younger of the group here.
Probably. I'm like 23. No, I'm just... But, Joey, you were talking about... the first chapter of the book, and I wanted to mention something that I had never heard of in the first chapter, and that was necklacing, which is a form of like torture, you know, execution. Is that something you were already familiar with, Vern, or something that you did research for? It's like, oh, this is a cool method to, you know, dispose of this person. Let's add this in.
Well, it was something that was going on in the world a fair bit at that time when I started the book. One of my things I used to do in terms of my process, and I'm just getting back into it. You know, we're going back to the day where, you know, there were a lot of physical newspapers and magazines. Mm-hmm. And I go to my coffee shop every day, which is in the book, and the Jet Fuel. And I would, gather up the papers. I would, you know, read the papers or whatever fascinated me from the papers. And I would cut things out and put them in a scrapbook. And there were a lot of articles throughout the world on necklacing at that point. And I did want to get away. It wasn't an ethical or moral concern, But I wanted to get away from a little bit from the use of guns. And it wasn't to say I didn't want guns included in the story, but you know, there's a lot of novels, and I'm guilty of this too. I don't know if guilty is the right word, but there's a lot of stories that end in a shootout, and that's fine. I'm not, you know, I'm not banging a drum on that and being critical, but you know, I said, you're in Canada. There's gotta be another way to do this. And, you know, necklacing, we have all the, you know, tools of production in terms of necklacing. We have tires, we have gas, we have Zippos, right? And so it was something that was easy and quick, and there wasn't a whole lot of tech to it. And I thought, okay, well, that, you know, that can be their sort of modus operandi.
So for those that don't know, in the chat, explain what necklacing is real quick, just so they get that good mental picture.
Basically, they soak a tire in gas and they fit it around your shoulders and they light it on fire.
Yeah, it'd be horrible.
Like when I read that part, the first, I was like, oh, this is setting the tone for sure. This is nice. Gary, when he brought this to you and you read it, was there anything that you were questioning? Because you were about to release it with Run Amok. I mean, were you like, okay, do you want to go that brutal that time, that right in the beginning there? Or, you know, were there terms that he was bringing in that you had to question yourself?
No, I implicitly trust Vern's judgment. Careful. It is brutal, but I mean, Vern has a way of tempering things with, I know he doesn't like necessarily want to be thought of as a comedic writer, and he is not, but he has a lot of funny moments, and I feel like it kind of offsets some of the brutality of that. But the one thing I did want to say about Vern and his novels, and all, they're all the same in that the plots are meticulously laid out. I mean, Vern is, you know, we're talking about how he's very detail oriented. His plots are that way as well. They're meticulously laid out. The cultural references, the pop cultural references are, you know, all over the place. And half of them you'll get, half of them you won't, you know, but they're great. They're so colorful. So I think that those kind of things tend to sort of offset that sheer brutality that necklacing is.
Yeah.
And I have to admit, I had not heard of that before. So
no, I hadn't either. I had to look it up. I was like, oh, that's really bad.
That's bad. Yeah. That's basically my reaction. Ooh, that's bad. That would hurt.
More of this. It's bad, but more of this. Keep it coming.
I did like that instead of, you know, just opposed to, you know, they pull out a gun and they shot the guy. You know,
yeah, right?
That happens all the time. And that can be, you know, boring and mundane after a while, but something different like that, something I had never heard of. So that's pretty brutal. I like throwing that in.
Right.
Yeah.
And that being like a calling card sort of as well was really cool.
Yeah. And what was the saying, Vern? With mocking of
Avec mocking.
Avec mocking.
He wanted the murdered Avec mocking.
Yeah, that's funny. So I mean, that's exactly what I'm talking about. That kind of that little bit of humor that sort of offsets it. And you know, that's what I like about it.
Okay. There is a question here in the chat. Yeah, Jay, you would go ahead and jump.
Which one is it?
One from earlier. Can Vern talk more about the racism within Canadians from Quebec to British Columbia? Because that plays out a little bit in the book as well.
Well, I don't think it's so much British Columbia. It's traditionally it's between Quebec and the rest of Canada.
Everybody else.
And
Quebec and everybody else.
the thing is, and you know, it's I get I'm not Quebecois, obviously. You know, but I spent a lot of time in Quebec and Montreal in particular. And you know, as an outsider, I think sort of became a little bit more familiar with some of the intricacies of Quebec culture. And, you know, Quebec I was having a conversation with recently with Tia Genet, the Pulitzer nominated playwright in Chicago, just down the street from me here. And I was talking about Quebec culture, and, you know, she sort of laughed at me and said, you know, Quebec doesn't have its own culture. And that's the argument. That's the argument that has been within Canada my whole life. And, you know, to me, Quebec is kind of a country within a country, and that's what a lot of Quebecers think of it. And, you know, so I think there was always a feeling when I was growing up, you know, it sort of felt like the rest of Canada was encroaching on Quebec. And so they've done a lot of things to quote unquote protect their culture, which mm-hmm. I often don't agree with, but on some level I understand. And they have Quebec only sign or French only signs. And so, you know, I understand it on one hand. On the other hand, it's pretty ridiculous to me that a Vietnamese restaurant would have to have a French sign, you know, or something along those lines. But, you know, there's there are things like if you move to Quebec and if you're an immigrant and, you know, your children have to go to a French school, whereas if you're born there, they can go anywhere they want. And so a lot of these things have created some conflict with the rest of the country. And for the longest time, it was us and them. And Quebec's also it's a province that was, you know, for a long time was under the thumb of the Catholic Church. And so there's not really much sympathy for religion there, regardless of what your religion is. You know, you can be, you know, you can have a history of cocaine and still be the premier or the governor, you know, but they don't want you showing up in a priest collar or anything else for that matter. And so I think it's sort of graduated to the point where it's not so much between Quebec and the rest of Canada at some point, although that remains. I think there's a lot of friction now in that it's a more multicultural society. And, you know, to a certain extent, I shouldn't say to a certain extent, to a large extent, you know, again, they're feeling... Quebecois are feeling encroached upon by someone else at this point. So, you know, they're not so mad at the rest of us, you know. but it is, it's the type of thing. There are people I know, somebody very close to me used to go on ski trips to Quebec. And we're from Windsor, which is right across the river from Detroit. And, you know, if this gentleman met a woman in Quebec, he would say he was from Detroit. So he wouldn't catch hell for being a Canadian who didn't speak French, you know? And that's another part of it. That's another part of it. We're a bilingual country. And I mean, if I was in a life or death situation or needed to find where Jim Morrison's gravesite was, I could, you know, sort of hack and fake my way through it.
Right.
Ouais, Jim Morrison, you know, and, which was my experience when I went to Paris, you know.
Jim Morrison.
You know, and we're trying to find his burial site, you know. And so it's like that. It's always been like that. You know, there's been a lot of threats of separation and votes. To separate, which the separatists, I think, have always lost, if I'm correct, or mostly lost anyways, because they're still there. But there's always been a tension there, you know, and a certain stridency there, where, you know, in terms of British Columbia, things are more laid back and everything is permissible. And, you know, in Quebec, not everything is permissible.
And I think also one thing in the book too, Vern, that comes out is that they really have a culture unto their own, you know, their own music, their own movies, you know, there's a lot that even outside of Quebec and Canada, people don't know about Quebecois culture.
Oh, you're absolutely right. And they, you know, it's a province that supports their arts in a major way. There are movies that are made that are, you know, for the most part, never shown outside of Quebec. And, you know, now we're getting into something else. But, you know, the Parisians think that the French Canadians speak a very "quote unquote" provincial version of French,
yeah,
and you know, and so, you know, there's not even, you know, there's not even an appreciation between Quebec and Paris that there should be, although there is, you know, there are some ties between the two, but yeah, you have movies that are top notch movies that are made in Quebec that are never really shown out of the province. You have literature that you know, for the most part, is a Quebec phenomenon, and I love it there, and I love old Montreal, and you know, there I have a lot of you know, I have a lot of fond memories of Quebec, but there's always been something between Quebec and the rest of Canada, or Quebec and the rest of whoever's coming to Canada, and you know, it's because, you know, they see their culture as fragile, and you know, will do anything to protect it, even some things that, like I said, while I understand and try to understand, I can't always agree with them.
Right. I mean, it's so interesting to see that it's that extreme, because I mean, I've heard bits and pieces about it before, but I mean, here in the States, we have our own issues too. Trust me. So
yeah.
those issues kind of overshadow everything else. But I think we've been told bits and pieces of that story before. And I just didn't realize it was that extreme. And it's just, you know, from an outsider looking at it, you know, I'm wondering, you know, what's going on. But then I see what's happening in the States here. So we could kind of relate a little bit, but go ahead, Brad.
I was just going to say, did you feel it important to add sort of those aspects in just for the authenticity of the story? And it's not like something you're just hammering on the whole time, but it's bits and pieces here and there throughout.
Well, I think, you know, to a certain extent, I it may not look like it, but I do, a lot of my writing is stream of consciousness. And so it's, you know, stuff that occurs to me in the moment when I'm on a roll. But certainly I wanted to demonstrate the differences between the two cultures, the tensions between the two cultures and the differences between the two cultures. And, you know, we've got a Hell's Angel in there, Jean Max, from Quebec. And that's also a big part of our culture. You know, I think biker culture has sort of, you know, been brought to heel in the last 10, 15 years. But at that point, the biker wars in Quebec were just over the top. And, you know, while there were biker wars in Ontario and elsewhere in Canada, you know, Quebec was sort of the epicenter of it. And so it was something, you know, it was, I always say that the story is where everybody else is not. And I'm sure I'm missing something, but I don't recall being aware of a lot of fiction depicting Quebecois bikers. And so, you know, and so I looked at that, and it's not like, you know, I was the first, but it was again, it was something that you know, the story is where everyone else is not, and nobody seemed to be on that part of the story, and so that was something I grabbed for myself.
So are the Hells Angels pretty prevalent in Canada? Because I didn't know that they were.
Yes, and I at least they were, like I said, and uh-huh. You know, Joseph S. Pete has a great story in Jacked about the biker wars here, and you know, it's they're sort of at the end of the line, you know, in terms of pulling a lot of nickel and dime stuff, and mm-hmm. I think at this point that's where we are in Canada as well. But like I said, if you go back 10, 15 years, 20 years, you know, the biker wars were pretty extreme, particularly in Quebec. And there was a lot of, you know, there was a lot of obvious sort of, you know, audacious stuff going on in regards to that. So it was easy to pull from.
For those who's joining us, we have a handful of new people in the chat. Of course, we're celebrating the release of Scratching the Flint. Tomorrow it hits the world. It's night, you know, what better way to celebrate than, you know, let's chat with the author and his special guest. Ver, before we get too far into this, do you want to maybe hop in and do your reading for it? Sure. and get things moving along with that?
Sure. And I'm going to give you a very brief reading. It's mm-hmm. it's about a page and a half, and we'll give you an introduction to Cecil. And at this point in the book, Cecil and his partner Alex have been not suspended, but kinda. And they've been sent home for the week. And you know, so Cecil's a little pissed off to begin with, but I think this will give you a good idea of how Cecil does business and his style of policing. Again, they've just been, you know, unofficially suspended. Alex was so upset, like there was no way he was going to church tonight in this state, that he refused to drive Cecil home. No problem. Cecil was used to hoofing it. From the Eaton Center, he walked to St. Jamestown, Parliament Street, picked up a case of Keith's at the beer store. On the way out, he saw one of those fancy pants cars, a flamboyant station wagon, probably from Operation Cooperation, pull into a handicap space near the door. The car had wheelchair vanity plates, Mohican. Yep, this was one of the defrauders. Cecil couldn't recall every detail, but he specifically remembered vanity wheelchair plates on an old-fangled wagon. And talk about disrespect. The bespeckled dumpling inside swung his door open like he didn't have a care, walking breezily towards Cecil in an ironic Bigfoot t-shirt. Apparently Bigfoot had seen this adult male, whoever he was, probably another legend in his own mind. I'd get back in my car, I was you. Cecil held his case with both hands, chin nodding across the lot, and park it in a natural walking man spot. What? The guy pointed at his bumper. I've got wheelchair plates. Trouble is, you're a natural walking man. Tilting his head, the guy maintained eye contact, looking at Cecil through utilitarian dark frame glasses. So what's it to you? That did it. Cecil took a half dozen steps and slammed his case on the hood, turning, listening to a few bars of the guy complain about what that was going to do to his sea blue paint. Had to be ordered special. Cecil flashed his shield, saying whoa up when the guy dared take a step forward. Sorry, officer, he held his hands high. I didn't realize, nodding to his plates. And I know how it looks, but I have a right to that space. How's that? Bringing his hands down, the guy said, I have an invisible illness. Invisible illness, my ass. Let's see your license. Come on, the guy said. Cecil waved at himself until the guy produced his wallet, removing his driver's permit. Cecil took it, looking at the guy's name, Gervais Garrett. Cecil couldn't see as how a dumpling in a Sasquatch shirt had anything to do with Doyle's demise, but memorized the pertinent info anyway, handing the license back. Thank you, Mr. Garrett. Chin nodding across the lot again. Now I'm telling you, park that ancient piece of shit, probably gets a kilometer to the gallon, in a natural walking man spot before I bust you for being a fraudulently acquiring cripple plates rat bag. There's no fraud, Gervais said. My paperwork checks out. But you don't, Cecil pointed at the guy. Now move it. Cecil followed Gervais, who stepped into his wagon, keying the ignition. Cecil retrieved his case of Keith's, watching Gervais back out and park in a natural walking man spot.
Nice. Nice. Passion there. I like it.
I just want to say that the descriptor there, bespectacled dumpling, is a good example of what we were talking about earlier with dialing back on the physical description to get with less is more.
Right.
Yeah. Sorry, go ahead.
No, go ahead, Vern.
Well, I was just going to say they were fun characters to deal with. And you know, this is all set in the neighborhood I lived in Toronto on Bleecker Street. I was in a co-op on Bleecker Street, and where Cecil lives is, you know, probably about 100 yards down the street in one of the townhouses there. And so this neighborhood, and we talk about it in the book, St. Jamestown, it's one of the most densely populated. It is the most densely populated neighborhood in Canada. And, you know, people living on top of people, we're all crammed. It's too small of a space and we're pissing each other off. And so a lot of this stuff happened from things I was seeing and experiencing at the time. And so it was easy to dial that in because we're all feeling the same thing. And you know, we're in a space. I mean, it gets hot during the summer. Everybody just goes crazy wild because we're all on top of each other, you know? You know, the morning of 9/11, I got my only jaywalking ticket. I went out to get cat food and ran across the street on a red light. And so whenever anything was going on in the city or the world, and it was hot and the temperature, you know, other than the heat, you know, things sort of got turned up and keyed up and you'd have all that stimuli. And there were a lot of things happening. It was a great place to write crime fiction. And there's not a whole lot of Canadian crime fiction that I'm aware of that's set in and around St. Jamestown and Cabbage Town. Hugh Garner had done some in the 60s and 70s that I'm very fond of, The Sin Sniper being one of those novels. But it was just a natural place to set a crime story. And police headquarters is not too far away. And so that worked out nicely. But yeah, it was just a really rich neighborhood for that way. And there was in terms of, it wasn't the most crime ridden part of Toronto, but
right. We
had about 17 halfway houses. There was a lot of activity there and it just, it was a community that really, worked into the story very naturally.
Well, I think your reading got a couple of people in chat here pretty interested in checking it out. Should we try a little contest, maybe get a copy out to someone?
Sure, sure. Well, we've got what I'm doing here for the contests is I'm giving away one of my earlier books along with a copy of Scratching the Flint, but you have to answer a skill testing question.
Oh, boy. Nobody told me there was going to be a test. Come on.
Oh, come on. Just giving it away. You got to work for it a little bit. So
make people sweat. Let's do this.
So the Green Ghetto is set in Detroit. So I have a Detroit question. 1984 World Series was played in Detroit. And so how many people attended the 1984 World Series and what were their names and addresses?
All of them.
Okay. So that's going to be a little bit too hard.
I do want to say something real quick for the giveaway. Is it international shipping, U.S. only?
I'll do international. Okay, so this is something people can cheat on. Who is Detroit's most famous burlesque performer? The most famous burlesque performer to come out of Detroit, a female burlesque dancer. And, you should be able to Google that anyway.
I was going
to
say, everybody's hitting their Google right now.
Yeah.
So first person to put that in the chat can win a copy of The Green Ghetto and the brand new Scratching with Flint.
We should play
some Jeopardy music.
Let's play some Jeopardy music.
We'll get copyrighted and taken down.
Yeah.
So repeat the question for everybody again, Vern.
Who is the most famous burlesque dancer to come out of Detroit?
So I'm going to Google it too.
Well, we need the Jeopardy music.
Is it Kwame Brown? Is that correct?
No,
that's not who I found.
Okay, well this is gonna do people. James says no. Google. Okay, Articula Mattis. She's got it. Lottie the Body.
Okay.
And Lottie the Body is mentioned in The Green Ghetto. And so that'll be going out to, it looks like, Tia Genet, the aforementioned Pulitzer nominee from Chicago. Nice. I can see congratulations on postage there.
Yeah, you lucked out there, didn't you?
Just walk it over.
Yeah. Just meet at one of the coffee shops and just hand it off. There you go.
So I do want to say, at least in America, there's sort of the stereotype about Canada. And me and Jay have a friend that lives in Canada where everyone's really nice. Everyone's very apologetic all the time. You know, there's no fighting or anything like that. So what is the importance for you of presenting Canadian crime fiction out to people to let people know that, you know, it's not just all everyone's all nice and lovey-dovey and saying they're sorry all the time in Canada, which is sort of the stereotype in America a bit about how Canadians are.
Well, the first part's true. I mean, I apologize all the time. I've got no business apologizing. Oh, I'm sorry. You know, and so we do that. We say a lot and, you know, a lot and things like that. And there is less crime, you know. And part of the reason for that is we do have strict gun control. And, you know, another reason for that is we address some of the causes of crime through socioeconomic issues, through healthcare and other social safety nets. But you know, the notion that there's not crime or violence is, you know, sort of an inaccurate stereotype. There is less of it. Right. But, you know, in my hometown, Windsor, you know, there was a killing when I was living there pre-2016. Wasn't far from where I lived, actually, in Little Italy. And, you know, they grabbed some guy. They took him into the garage. They obviously didn't have guns. They burned him to death. And then they, you know, put his carcass in the trunk and dumped him in a farmer's field in the county, you know. When I was living in Toronto, right on Bleecker Street, the street where Cecil lives in Scratching the Flint, we had a situation where there was a nightclub across the street, and residents in my building were complaining of gunfire and got in touch with the police and the local city councilor, and they said, no, you know, people are just setting off firecrackers, right? And, you know, it couldn't have been after we got that answer 3 days later. And, you know, there were three people executed coming out of that club.
Wow.
You know, over a 3 or 4 day stretch. And you know, we have big festivals in Toronto, and inevitably somebody's son or daughter doesn't come home, and they wound up being found in Lake Ontario 2 weeks later or something like that. So, and certainly Cabbage Town, you know, where I was living in Toronto, Cabbage Town, St. James Town, is we have a little bit of a discussion on the disputed geography between that. And, you know, I've had people, I've had someone on the way to dinner at my house get mugged. I when I lived in Kensington Market, we had people over for dinner and they went downstairs and, you know, somebody was shot at the karaoke and crawling out on the sidewalk. And this was the damnedest thing. There were a lot of karaokes in Toronto and there were a lot of shootings at karaokes. And you know what? It's over exactly what you think it's about. Somebody's making fun of somebody singing. Somebody goes out to the car, comes back with a gun and blam. You know, and and I've been mugged in my hometown of Windsor. When I was 15, I was mugged. And so, you know, to the notion that there's no crime or very little crime is incorrect, but it is dwarfed from what's going on in American cities. I'm about, I live about 20, 25 minutes outside of Chicago. And, you know, there are 1,000 people, 800 to 1,000 people a year dying of gunshot wounds.
Right.
And so, you know, there's certainly an imbalance. And I'm sure you look at the two and Toronto, you know, looks like great shakes. But on a lot of levels, you know, as the aforementioned Tia Genet says, you know, Toronto's just as effed up as Chicago.
is there a large crime fiction community for, you know, Canadian authors writing Canadian crime fiction, or is it not as much as we would think?
It's probably not as much as we would think. You know, part of the reason for that is, I would say about 90% of all fiction published in Canada is granted. And so it sounds great. And certainly the grant system in Canada doesn't owe me anything. I've been very fortunate to get funding there on more than one occasion. And I am thankful for that. But the thing you have to understand is when you accept money from the government to write something, that's going to change what you write. And, because you want more, right? And that's the thing. And so now you're writing for the government on a certain level. And, and, you know, that does play out. And that's why we, you know, there's certain stuff that's not going to get granted. And that's why we have pimps, but we have no literary answer to Iceberg Slim or Donald Glantz. And it's not to say that those characters aren't there or those writers aren't there. It's that they're not popular in a government funded system. And so, you know, and so there are great Canadian books and there are writers in Canada who are extremely important to me as a reader. Evelyn Lau's early work is, I've went and seen her read about three times. I adore her early work. Crad Kolodny, who Evelyn Lau and Crad Kolodny didn't get along, but I love him too. And you know, there's a ton of great stuff that's been there, but it's uneven, and there are a lot of holes in terms of things we don't have an answer to, and you know, the crime fiction scene is certainly smaller, and you know, it's like here, it's very politically charged, but there's not a lot of opportunities. And you'll see with the Arthur Ellis Awards or whatever they're calling them now, you know, most of the, or I shouldn't say most of, that's not correct. A lot of the awards won by Canadian writers have come from publishing in American publications. And it's, you know, if you're a crime writer, it's a small country. You know, other than the big cities, Geographically, it's very big, but there's just not that many people. And it's just not the same number of opportunities. And you know, it's sort of one of the reasons why we're here. If everything was perfect in Canada, we wouldn't have left. But there are a lot more opportunities for us here. And, you know, I didn't come for the opportunities. I came for love, but my love came for the opportunities. And so, so I figure while I'm here, I may as well, you know, make the most of these opportunities that aren't at home.
I was just wondering when you were talking about the crime in Canada and you said someone was, someone got mugged on their way to your place for dinner. Did they apologize for being late when they got there?
They actually did. I mean, because they were really late.
Yeah. Typical Canadian.
Yeah. They had to go home and change and everything. But they actually did. They actually did. It's my friend Garth from Toronto.
So as we start winding down a little bit, Gary, I want to ask you, this book's coming out tomorrow. What are some of the outlets people can pick it up? From Run Amok directly or Amazon, or is there going to be in some bookstores? What are we looking at here?
Yeah, you can get it from any online vendor. Our distributor is Ingram, so any online vendor. Some bookstores may have it, but you can certainly order it if they don't have it. Okay.
You can get it through Walmart, which blew my mind.
Yeah.
Really? That's cool.
You can get it through pretty much anywhere you want. We like IndieBound and bookshop.org, but, you know, because they're, you know, but Amazon, of course, it's there. And we would strongly encourage you to go to your local bookstore and order it through them, but that's up to you.
Gentlemen, it's been a pleasure. I'm Vern. I'm almost done with it. I didn't get to the very end. So I'm glad you didn't give any kind of like major spoilers. So.
Everyone does at the end, Jay. All over.
The butler did it. But thanks again for the whole panel, Vern, for, you know, asking us, and Gary for asking us if we want to put together a little something for you for this book release. So hopefully everyone in the chat, I'm sure they're going to go out and get, you know, and the people watching this tomorrow, the next day. They'll pick it up. So again, thank you very much. Joey, thanks for stopping by. AB, thanks for stopping by. Really appreciate it. It's like your own support group here. You should just make your rounds now.
I need one.
To all the late night talk shows, just bring your posse with you. So.
Yeah, especially in this country.
Thanks to you guys, Brad and Jay. We appreciate it. We appreciate the support.
Yeah, not a problem. Yeah, that's what we do.
More than anything, thank you very much. The editorial process is very taxing on me, and we've just finished that. And so it's nice to just have some fun with something. It was a lot of fun having a drink with you guys tonight. Yeah. And I, you know, 2023, this is basically a night out for me. So, so thank you very much. And thank you all.
Our buddy Chad Lutsky's here.
Yeah, so we got to start over.
Start over and do this.
Every time he comes in, we have to start over for Chad. Yeah.
So, Chad, yeah, that's going to do it. Scratching the Flint tomorrow. It hits the world.
Pick it up.
It should be on your Let's Buy This list.
Some premiere, not just crime fiction, but Canadian crime fiction. Get yourself a copy.
Gary, this is under the Run Amok Crime section, yes. Right? Okay. Yeah. Just want to make
Run
sure.
Amok Crime.
Run Amok Crime.
Yep.
For our panel here, thanks so much for stopping by. Everyone in the chat, thank you for stopping by. And we have a winner in the chat, so Vern will take care of that. Congratulations. That's going to do it, Brad. That's a pretty nice release party, right?
Vern, do you have any parting words, friend?
Well, you're putting me on the spot. obviously, I want people to read the book, and that's why we write them. And this is something that you know helps us get word out there in terms of you know, creating awareness about the book. But you know, mostly, like I said, it's you know, when I write a book, I have a lot of fun with it, and I want the people to read it to enjoy themselves as well. And, you know, but it's also important that I have a nice night out every once in a while. And this has been a really nice night. So thank you to all five of you. I really do appreciate it. And we will see you out there.
All right. Thanks,
everyone. Appreciate you. Care,
everyone. Thanks, folks.
We'll see you next time. See ya.
Jay, I love you, man.
I know you do.